You're listening to The Sound Off. The Sound Off. With the Solomonster. Solomonster.
When an angry black man is talking, y'all need to shut it up! When I see opportunity, I'm gonna take it. You kick my dog, I'm gonna kick your cat.
Welcome to episode... What episode is this? I've lost track. I don't even know what number show this is. I'm sorry. I was watching something on YouTube and got completely involved with it. I've actually discovered a YouTube channel that has, in clips, of course, in different clips, the entire episode each week of Wipeout, which I think I've mentioned before. Wipeout, here in the U.S., the game show, it is the best show on television. I not a week goes by that I watch the show and not only smile, but laugh my ass off. I mean, I could be having the worst day in the world, and I guarantee that if I watch this TV show, it will lift my spirits in a heartbeat. It is the best show of anything on television. So if you haven't seen Wipeout, you can actually go on YouTube. There's a YouTube channel called Wipeout Uploads, and they have clips from each of the recent shows in parts uploaded there. You can watch it. Do yourself a favor and just check this thing out, because... I laugh my ass off every single time. And as they say, laughter is the best medicine. Anyway, this is episode 159 of the Solomonster Sounds Off. Solomonster here with you. It is Sunday, May 15th, 2011, where wrestling matters. That's right, wrestling matters. I'll talk about that a little bit later, but first things first, I want to mention the... big UFC news that broke, which involves a former WWE champion. A couple of days ago, we found out that Brock Lesnar, who was supposed to fight Junior Dos Santos at UFC 131, I believe, which is up in Vancouver, on pay-per-view next month. Of course, Lesnar and Dos Santos are the two respective coaches this season on Ultimate Fighter, which, from everything I've read, Ultimate Fighter has not been a very entertaining show this season. And anyway, usually the season will culminate with the two coaches going head-to-head in a fight on pay-per-view, and Lesnar, of course, means big box office for UFC, but not this time, because unfortunately he was forced to withdraw from his fight. He'll be replaced by Shane Carwin, who Lesnar actually beat, I believe, in a fight last year. Unfortunately, he's been stricken with another bout of diverticulitis, which is nothing to... It's nothing to think is not serious. It's actually very serious, and Lesnar, this is his second encounter with diverticulitis. The time he had it previously was a very serious situation. They thought he would need potentially career-ending surgery, which he was able to avoid, and he made this big comeback and seemingly had conquered the illness and made this nearly miraculous recovery, which I guess was not so miraculous after all, because Lesnar has said that he never actually got rid of the diverticulitis per se. He was still not 100% of what he was before, and it hit him again. He noticed that he wasn't able to train the way that he likes to train. There was something wrong. He went to the doctor. They did a whole battery of tests. And, you know, he was taking some medicine that wasn't working. And, yeah, he's out of the fight. Nobody knows when he may be able to fight. He may never be able to fight again. Lesnar said he's not retiring. He will fight again. But, really, with this, you never know. And the one difference now, as opposed to before, is that he may not have any choice as far as going in for the surgery. I think the surgery would require... that they removed part of his colon. It's actually similar to a surgery that Jim Ross underwent, which, again, is you know, not... I suppose it's potentially fatal if left untreated, but in this situation, it's not so much life-threatening as it is potentially career-threatening. You know, Brock is not getting any younger. He's in his mid-30s, and really in the prime, you could say, of his fighting career. You know, if Lesnar has to undergo surgery and he's out and doesn't have another fight for 2 or 3 years... You know, what kind of fighter is he going to be at the age of 36 or 37 when he gets back? Of course, the bigger question here, could this lead to a professional wrestling return? Could we see Brock Lesnar back in WWE? I don't see it, quite frankly, which is not to say that I don't see Brock Lesnar eventually, at some point, wrestling a match for Vince McMahon or doing something with WWE. He wanted to do WrestleMania this year. Vince McMahon wanted it in the worst way. And Dana White wouldn't let him. Dana White said, listen, we got this guy under exclusive contract to UFC. We're not going to let him do WrestleMania. We're not going to let him do pro wrestling. And Of course, Vince ended up pulling a rabbit out of his hat anyway by getting The Rock. So I think in the end it worked out for WWE. But I cannot ever envision a scenario where Brock Lesnar comes back full-time or even part-time to WWE. He left. He didn't like the travel. He hates traveling. He just hates it with a passion. And even on a part-time schedule, you cannot go to WWE and not travel. It's unfortunately part of the job that you cannot avoid. But, you know, the other part of it also was all this talk about, well, if he can't fight, he can wrestle. Well, you know, professional wrestling training is every bit as difficult as MMA training. I'm not going to say which one is you know, more cumbersome than the other, because I don't do either. I'm not a wrestler, I'm not a fighter. A wrestler and a fighter, they're more equipped to answer that question. But there's almost this dismissive attitude that I've heard from people and I've read online of, well, you know, if he can't fight, he can go back to that fake shit in WWE. As though it's, you know, so easy just to step back in the ring and do professional wrestling. And it's not. It's not that easy at all. It's very hard on the body. It's another reason Brock left. Because he, you know, he saw a lot of very beat-up guys, and he didn't want to be one of those run-down, beat-up pro wrestlers in 10 years. So, I don't know what the future holds for Brock Lesnar. I wish him all the best. It's a shitty situation. We have a family friend who also has diverticulitis, so I have heard stories firsthand from somebody who is not Brock Lesnar, which is to mean a normal person who is not the freak of nature that Brock Lesnar is. And Brock's, you know, he's an athlete. You know, he's in great shape. And even he has fallen victim before to this disease to the point where he was in a bad way. So imagine what it's like for a normal person being afflicted with something like this. It's not a fun disease to have. And so I don't know that he's made a decision one way or the other on whether or not he's going to have surgery. But if he does, I wish him the best. I hope he comes out of it with flying colors and is able to get back and do whatever he wants to do. Even if he's not 100%, hopefully he'll be able to make a living and get back to doing what he likes doing. It's a shitty story, but, you know, what are you going to do? Shane Carwin will face Junior Dos Santos. And I guess the winner of that fight will get Cain Velasquez. I don't know. I guess we'll find out soon enough. But that's a big fight off the books for UFC. I mean, when Brock Lesnar fights, you're talking potentially about a million buys or more on pay-per-view. And that's big business right there. And without Brock Lesnar, UFC loses a lot of money. So it really is not a good situation for anybody involved except Shane Carwin, who now gets to step in and has the opportunity of a lifetime. So another name that was talked about this week, last couple of days, is the Pope. Pope D'Angelo De Niro of TNA. A lot of speculation that he is leaving TNA after a bit of a cryptic message posted on his Twitter page that said, and I quote, "My time has come. It's time to move on. I've served well. Hope none has been disappointed. Hope my hard work has been applauded and appreciated." Now, for what it's worth, there was an earlier tweet on his page from May 9th that indicated that he recently graduated and received his degree with honors in criminal justice. So, you know, without knowing for sure what the hell he means by all this, you can take from that perhaps he's going to pursue something outside of pro wrestling. You know, that's certainly the impression that I was left with. You know, he was posting for days on his Twitter account the date 5/13/11, which supposedly was the same day his TNA contract was to have expired, although I have not seen this 100% confirmed anywhere else. So if that was the day his TNA contract was supposed to expire, supposedly, and then he posts something like that, it certainly leaves the door open, one would think, for the possibility that he is gone from TNA. But then again, all these Wrestling Matters videos that TNA has posted on YouTube and on their website, they posted a whole bunch of different 30-second videos with different wrestlers on why wrestling matters to them. And one of those videos that's up on their own YouTube page right now that was put up within the last day or two is with the Pope. So the Pope talks about why wrestling matters and why he's part of TNA. So I don't know what the hell is going on. Nobody seems to know. He has not clarified anything. So I guess we're just left to wonder what happens next. TNA has not been doing a whole lot with the Pope, although he was on their last pay-per-view. I don't know that he's been on TV too much of late, or certainly the focus has not been on him. My impression is that this could be the end for him in TNA, but until we hear from him, nobody seems to know for sure. So that's really the only update I can give on the Pope for the people who have asked. I'm going by what You know, he's posted on Twitter. Again, supposedly, May 13th was the expiration of his TNA contract, but I have not seen that confirmed, you know, on more than maybe one or two websites, so I can't really say for sure. But you know what? He got his degree in criminal justice. Even if he doesn't leave wrestling, that's awesome. You know, congratulations to him. It's always good to have something to fall back on. You know, Jim Ross talks about that all the time when he talks to younger guys. Get your education first, and then become a wrestler. So in this case, he became a wrestler first, but that's fine. Mickey James, I think, either has or is still currently going for her degree, I think, online. I don't remember in what. I think that's fantastic. And you know what? If he ever did decide to leave wrestling altogether to pursue something in the criminal justice field, good for him. You know, he got to live his dream. He got to be a pro wrestler. He attained some level of notoriety doing it. I don't remember him winning any major championships, but, you know, one can't judge another person just based on how many titles they won, especially in 2011 when they don't really mean all that much. So I say good for the Pope. You know, good for him. So let's go back to Monday night. I got some thoughts on Tough Enough and Raw, as always. On Tough Enough, which is really heating up, we had Ivelisse, one of the two remaining women on the show, and Eric Watts, who in fact is not the son of Bill Watts, but he's the big guy with the afro. Both of them were eliminated this week. Two eliminations on Tough Enough, which leaves, I believe, six competitors left. And it looks like the winner is going to be announced on a live 3-hour edition of Raw from the Nassau Coliseum in my backyard on June 13th. I will not be there, which is a shame because apparently Steve Austin is going to be on that show. It's always a good time when the glass shatters and Steve Austin shows up on Raw. John Morrison was the big star on the show this week. They had an obstacle course where they had to the competitors had to walk across like a tightrope. They had to climb the ropes. It was something, again, has nothing to do with pro wrestling. I guess it has everything to do with coordination and other qualities that they claim they're looking for. At the end of the day, it has nothing to do with wrestling. It's all for TV, and, you know, it's reality TV. It is what it is. So John Morrison was there to give some advice. You know, obviously Morrison is a very talented guy, a former gymnast. He can move and contort his body in ways that very few people can. He's very well balanced and coordinated. So who better to give advice on this particular day than John Morrison? I will say this, and I don't want to pick on the guy because I don't hate John Morrison, contrary to what some people think. I don't hate the guy. And obviously he's recovering from neck surgery right now. Melina, on her website, therealmelina.net.com, whatever it is, gave an update a couple of days ago. And, you know, the first week is always the roughest. Morrison has had a very tough week. He's still in a lot of pain from the surgery, but so he's recovering. He'll be back in about 4 to 6 weeks. But even on this show, in what I assume is a non-scripted situation where he's just giving advice, he talks like a robot. He really does. I mean, he talks like a machine and not a real person. There's just, he's got to loosen up a little bit. Maybe it's just his cadence. Maybe it's just the way he speaks. I remember those old dirt sheets with him and The Miz, and I think they did a live dirt sheet on SmackDown once that was pretty goddamn good. So it's not that the guy can't, you know, talk like he's having a normal conversation with somebody and show some personality, but goddamn, I mean, he's on the show, he's giving advice, he's just giving some advice very casually to the people on the show, and he talks like he's reading from a script on Monday Night Raw. Anyway, on the show coming up this Monday, two people are injured, apparently. That's the big hook for the show. And I know one of the people who gets hurt, I wasn't going to say who it was, but in the last commercial I saw on USA for Tough Enough, the latest commercial, they pretty much show footage of one of the people who gets hurt. He's one of the front runners in the competition. I may as well just say it. Martin, who has really been running neck and neck with Luke. You know, Martin, of course, the guy they used to call Donny Osmond, who has really shown the trainers quite a bit. He's won a whole bunch of competitions in recent weeks and blown everybody else out of the water. Apparently injures his ankle on the show this week. I don't know if he breaks it or what. You know, when they had the Tough Enough cast live on Raw that very first night when Tough Enough debuted on USA, which would have been right after WrestleMania, they had all the Tough Enough kids, remember, in the ring, and Steve Austin was there, and they were telling Austin, you know, stun them all, stun them all. Apparently, I don't know that you would be able to tell by watching, but Martin was hurt even then. You know, he was still, I think, on crutches, and they sent him out there without crutches or anything because they didn't want to give away the fact that he got hurt. But apparently he's the one who gets hurt. The other person who gets hurt, I assume, based on the commercial, is Christina Crawford, the one remaining female competitor. I don't know that for a fact. I'm just judging on the commercial. They show a spot where she's coming off the top rope, and I guess she hurts her leg, her knee in some way. So anyway, it should be an interesting show. I'm not going to be around tomorrow night. I'm heading out to Citi Field. I'm a glutton for punishment. I'm going to a Mets game, but I'm sure I'll be able to catch clips of Tough Enough and Raw on YouTube after the fact, but should be a good episode. We're winding down here. I'm a big fan of Tough Enough. I hope it gets picked up for a second season. I haven't heard one way or the other. I know Steve Austin was part of some upfront presentations recently, I think in New York. Maybe it was L.A. for pitching a second season of the show. No word on whether or not it got picked up. The ratings that the show does in the hour before Raw are not nearly as strong as the ratings that those NCIS reruns do, typically. So if you judge it based on that, they're probably not going to bring back the show. But I hope they do. And if they do, maybe they can move it to the time slot after Raw so that Raw ends and it segues right into Tough Enough, because to me, you might get more of an audience that way. You know, that's how The Ultimate Fighter, when it first debuted on Spike, that's how that show took off. You know, Spike wanted to put Ultimate Fighter on right after Raw because they wanted that Raw audience, that wrestling audience, to see this MMA show and stick around. And I think many of you probably have heard this story that the network had to go to Vince McMahon. They wanted Vince's blessing that he was okay with them putting this MMA reality show on after Raw. And if Vince would have said no, they probably wouldn't have done it. But, you know, this was back in, what, 2005, 2006? Actually, no, probably was a little before that, because I think they went back to USA in 05. So it was probably 04, 05. And they went to Vince, and they said, Vince, are you okay with this? And Vince was like, yeah, sure, no problem, put it on. And as they say, the rest is history. It took off after that. So we'll see what happens. But I really would like to see Tough Enough come back. Steve Austin has said that if they come back with a second season of the show, he's already got a couple of ideas on how to improve it, how to tweak it, how to change it a little bit, make it better. He obviously wants to do it again. He's really excited. And it's a way for him to get back in wrestling without actually having to wrestle. I think that maybe is why he likes it the most. And it keeps him current. You know, he's on television every week, too, and it's not a bad gig to have. So hopefully they'll bring this show back. So then we have Raw. We have Monday Night Raw, which, to me, was another ho-hum show. Not a bad show, but not a particularly good one either. Just very boring to me. You know, the fact that the Key Arena website, Key Arena is where Raw was held last Monday, the fact that on the arena's website they went and spoiled the main event of Over the Limit long before Raw even aired. You know, I even announced on this show last week because I thought it was common knowledge that it was announced. Apparently it was not. That John Cena and The Miz would have an I Quit rematch for the title at the pay-per-view. I think I announced that on the Sound Off last week. You know, the fact that they went and essentially spoiled it before it even aired made the build-up throughout this show pointless to me because I knew exactly who was winning and who was getting the next title shot. And I knew what the stipulation was going to be because they already announced it was going to be an I Quit match. So that probably did more to harm my enjoyment of the show than anything else. You know, when you already know what the outcome is going to be, and they go through all this trouble in the opening segment with all these guys to set up a triple threat and you know, who's going to get the title shot, and John Cena gets to pick the stipulation, and you already know what it is. It's not as fun. But I also like how I gave Vince McMahon credit last week on 158 for quietly bringing back Jim Ross. And then he's not even on the show this week. It's like, really? Thanks a lot, Vince. That's great. Anyway, I'm going to break this down a little bit differently than I have in recent weeks. First, I'm going to talk about the positives of this show, the things I liked. R-Truth, for example, continues his string of amazing promo work. The man is gold on the microphone. Here's a guy that a month ago, 6 weeks ago, I could not give two shits about. You know, if you were going to do cuts after WrestleMania, which they haven't done yet, but I'm sure they will at some point, R-Truth may well have been on my list. The guy just didn't do anything for me. And I thought, you know, that week when he fucked up the name of the city, and then they pretty much squashed him, I think, the week after, or maybe it was the same week in a match against Mason Ryan, I said, this guy, his days are numbered. And then they did the heel turn, and wouldn't you know it, it has breathed new life into the R-Truth character, to the point where I would love to see them put the title on him. I think a heel R-Truth, either chasing Cena for the championship, or if Cena chases him for the championship, there's money in that, just in the promo work, I think, between both guys. I really do. So R-Truth was great on the show. Ricardo Rodriguez delivering a drop kick to Alex Riley during the opening segment. I mean, I know he's a wrestler, I think he's actually training in FCW, but still, to see the guy in his shoes and his tux deliver a drop kick was awesome. Zack Ryder getting TV time this week, fist pumping with John Cena, that was pretty cool. And then we had a pretty good main event, but you know, it was nowhere near as good as Christian and Randy Orton from SmackDown the week before, but still a pretty good main event. So those were all the positives to me. Those are the big positives from Raw last Monday night. Now, we get to the negatives. Where do I begin? Well, I'll start here. I could do without all of the racial stuff that we saw in that opening segment. I will say that up front. I'm a pretty easygoing guy when it comes to these things. I'm not a politically correct kind of guy where things offend me very easily. And I'm not going to sit here and say this offended me greatly, but they did a lot of stupid stuff in that opening segment with the racial jokes back and forth about blacks and about Mexicans. I mean, hey, at least they're equal opportunity offenders, but do we really need all that bullshit? I mean, R-Truth's line about the angry black man was actually pretty funny, I will admit, but do we really need Miz and Truth out there talking about Taco Bell and fence jumping? Do these people realize that their Latino audience is growing more than any other audience? You would never guess that by watching this. Maybe they don't know. Maybe they haven't realized it yet. But it is. We had another battle between Kane and Mason Ryan. I'm not joking. I am not even kidding around. We had another Mason Ryan Kane match. Because their first match was so good, you see, we just had to have a rematch. Now, believe it or not, this was actually better, I felt, than their previous encounter, but that's not really saying much. I don't know what you accomplish. If you really want to push Mason Ryan by putting him in the ring with a guy that's bigger than him, Mason Ryan's a big dude. He's a big, jacked-up dude. I don't know how tall he is, although he seems like a pretty tall guy, and obviously he's very thick. He's very built. He's very muscular. Okay, he's a big guy. But you put him in the ring 2 weeks in a row, no less, with Kane, a man who is no slouch himself in the size department. Kane is 6'9". Okay, he's a lot closer to 7 feet than Mason Ryan is. 300 pounds. You know, Mason Ryan, you put him in there with like an Evan Bourne or a Yoshitatsu or any of those mid-card guys they have on the brand, and visually it would make him look even more impressive than he is. So that's one thing that I don't quite understand. I mean, the only thing that Mason Ryan has going his way is his look and his size. And you put him in there with two guys, no less. Not only Kane, but the Big Show, who dwarf him in size. And then you leave him laying with a double chokeslam. I don't get it. Anyway, Big Show was really fired up after that spot for some reason. He looked like a guy who was out there with something to prove. He was all fired up for some reason. We had Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler, the next chapter of this feud that will simply never die. I am so over this feud. I mean, I just want this shit to end. Cole announced that he was retiring from the ring undefeated and would be going into the Hall of Fame. So this brought Lawler into the ring, and he challenged Cole to yet another match. And here I thought Lawler was the babyface. And he, you know, as soon as he made this challenge, he automatically turned into a heel. Why would you do this to your fans? Only a heel would do that. So Lawler says this time, if Cole actually beat him again, not only would Lawler personally induct him into the Hall of Fame, but he would give Cole his own Hall of Fame ring. Jerry Lawler would give Michael Cole his Hall of Fame ring. So now we have WWE copying TNA storylines and the stuff that they did with Hogan and Flair and Abyss. You know, we need that about as much as we need more music from Justin Bieber. I mean, we don't. We don't need that at all. So Cole rejects this outright. He says he's not going to take the match. flees the ring back into the coal mine. And he proceeds to cut a promo about Mother's Day. Now, as soon as he said that, I knew exactly where they were going with this. They just had to have Cole remind everybody that Lawler's mom died in February and play it up for some cheap heel heat, which, by the way, they didn't even get. This was just fucking stupid. Lawler, to his credit, sold this like $1 million, which he always does. And he went after Cole. He looked like he was ready to kill the man. There was this one embarrassing moment here where Lawler was trying to get over the top of the coal mine to get in. And even though everyone could see the door was open, he insisted on trying to climb in over the top. So apparently Cole forgot to lock the door. And yeah, that was pretty embarrassing. So he had to pretend that he didn't see the open door. And then Jack Swagger came out, beat up Lawler, throwing him into the ring post, which we've seen him do 1,000 times before. So yeah, this sucked. This led to a U.S. title match between Jack Swagger and Kofi Kingston, a match that I'm not sure, but we may have seen this match maybe once before on SmackDown. Maybe twice. Anyway, Swagger had Kofi in the ankle lock when Lawler came back out for the distraction. Trouble in Paradise, Kofi retains the title. Lawler took out Swagger. He went back to the coal mine where he proceeded to reach in through one of the holes in the coal mine and yank Michael Cole by the tongue, which made for a funny visual, one that probably would have been funnier had we not already seen something similar at WrestleMania, or if we had not seen Daniel Bryan get fired for a similar tie-choking offense last year. So they get separated. Swagger says that Lawler is fired for touching Cole, and Lawler reminds him that he didn't touch Cole, he touched his tie. Swagger then accepts Lawler's challenge on Cole's behalf, which does not make Michael Cole very happy at all. So that match is set for Over the Limit. Lawler was great here. And, you know, he's 61 years old. At age 61, good for him, getting 4 pay-per-view payoffs in a row in 2011. But for fuck's sake, just end this feud already, please. I mean, I'm so through this with this feud. It's just not even funny. You know, Lawler got the title match with Miz in February at Elimination Chamber. Had a good match. Not the best match the two of them had, but whatever. It was fine. And a lot of people wanted Lawler to win the title in that match. And at one point, it was the plan, and they changed it, and it didn't happen. But whatever. Good for Lawler. He was on the pay-per-view. And then he was at WrestleMania, and then he was in the tag match with JR last month. So again, this will be his 4th consecutive pay-per-view payoff. I love Jerry Lawler, but you know what? 4 is enough. I think 4 is enough. Just end this feud. And while you're at it, end the anonymous Raw GM gimmick already. I mean, we know he's not running for president, so I say, just pay Donald Trump some money to cut a promo on the season finale of The Apprentice, you see. So instead of Trump announcing whether or not he's going to run for president on The Apprentice, which he says he will do, he cuts a promo on there, you see, announcing that he was the Raw GM all along. And in spite of their differences, he paid Vince McMahon good money for the gig just to entertain himself. And he only now realizes that his favorite wrestler, Bobby Lindsay, he did once call Bobby Lashley by the name of Bobby Lindsay. He realizes that Bobby Lindsay is no longer on the show. He didn't realize this until now. So he hereby surrenders the position. He has no interest in running Raw anymore. I came up with this in like 30 seconds the other day. I said, I have to leave a note here in my notes to mention this. This is a fine idea to end this stupid storyline. At least it would be funny. And it would get WWE some mainstream press, you know, at a time when Trump's name is in the news, even though Trump has made an ass out of himself recently. He's still a hot topic in the mainstream news cycle. So it's a win-win situation for everybody involved. Except Trump, I guess. But, you know, I don't know. Whatever they decide to do, just end this fucking thing already. I can't believe the Raw GM thing has been going on now. It's been, when did they start this? It's going to be a year, I think, in June or July. Next month. Yeah, it's almost a year. Because if I remember correctly, the Nexus attacked John Cena on that, remember that hot angle they did? It seems like years ago now, but they did that in June of last year. That was when Nexus attacked John Cena and tore up the ringside area. And I believe that the reason the Raw GM was anonymous was because he was afraid of retribution from Nexus. So he wanted his or her identity to be kept secret. So yeah, that would have been about a year ago. A year of this fucking bullshit. Miz, Alberto Del Rio, and Rey Mysterio had a triple threat match to determine the number one contender. And as far as triple threat matches go, this was pretty good. Mysterio had the match won before Alex Riley interfered. And for the people who pointed out that the referee saw this and wondering why he didn't call for the disqualification, because WWE does not have DQs in their triple threat matches. I mean, I'm pretty sure that as a rule, it's always been this way. You can argue that it doesn't make sense and it's stupid. You can make that argument, but this didn't bother me at all. I didn't criticize or say anything bad, really, about WWE when it comes to this, because I've always been of the impression that in triple threats and fatal four-ways, there is no DQ. I've never seen a disqualification in one of them before. I don't know why all of a sudden people take such a great issue with this. You can pick WWE's product apart for a million fucking different reasons. This didn't bother me. So we had Miz roll up Rey Mysterio for the pin. So what a surprise, he gets another title shot. Cena came out at this point to announce the I Quit stipulation. And am I the only one who noticed that he said that in this match there would be no DQs, no countouts, no pinfalls, and no submissions? What? Is saying the words I quit not considered a submission now? That was a pretty stupid line. I didn't see this mentioned anywhere else, so I'm sure I'm not the only one, but the fact that Cena is the biggest star in the company and either doesn't have the balls or the smarts to see something like that and say, hey, this doesn't make any sense, let's change it. The fact that he doesn't even do that is just amazing to me. Amazing. I'm not saying that he should do what Steve Austin and The Rock used to do, which is when they would be handed something stupid, they would laugh at it, crumple it in a ball, and throw it away. I'm not saying he has to do that. But, that didn't make any sense to me. Forget the whole triple threat DQ thing. This didn't make any sense. I watched SmackDown again this week. Second week in a row that I've been home on a Friday night and I've been able to watch this show start to finish, the entire show. And, again, it was another great wrestling show. Although, I will say the second hour dragged a little bit for me. It was a little boring. But, SmackDown alone was worth it for the Daniel Bryan Sin Cara match. And I've had a bunch of people post on Facebook and email me, oh, you've got to talk about the match, and you didn't see it. I did see it, and it was great. It was a great match. I don't know that I enjoyed it more than Christian and Orton from the week before. And that it's not exactly fair to compare, because that match, obviously that match was a world championship match with two main eventers. It went like 17 minutes. This didn't go anywhere close 17 minutes, but they did give these guys time. You know, Sin Cara had a great match with Tyson Kidd the week before that literally went 2 minutes. This went a lot more than 2 minutes. This may have gone over 10 minutes, and it went through a commercial break. This was a really, really fun match. And in one respect, it makes me sad to see that Daniel Bryan so far, he's got two losses and two appearances on SmackDown. It looks almost to me like he's being used as an enhancement talent. That's not the role for Daniel Bryan. He can excel. He can make anybody look good, but he deserves better than that. So I'm not going to complain yet. It's still very early. Maybe they'll do something with him, but he did a great job in this match. And Sin Cara, I think, is finding his groove. Still not a fan of that stupid blue light. Some people think it's cool. You know, it keeps the focus on the match. It's distracting. It doesn't keep the focus. You know, if they put the lights on, my focus would not be on anything but this match, regardless of what color light is there. It's distracting. It's stupid. Get rid of it. Cody Rhodes beat Ted DiBiase, and it really struck me here that, you know, with DiBiase here on SmackDown now and Drew McIntyre on Superstars, who lost to Chris Masters, I did watch Superstars this week, believe it or not, catching up on my wrestling here. You know, McIntyre had a match with Chris Masters in the main event on Superstars. That was good. You know, it wasn't like a great match or anything, but it was fine. And here's Drew McIntyre on WWE.com's Superstars, at least here in the States now. Superstars airs on the web. Internationally, it still may be on television, but Drew McIntyre losing clean on Superstars to Chris Masters. How the mighty have fallen. My, how the mighty have fallen. SmackDown, I got really angry with Michael Cole, surprise, surprise, but in this one particular instance, and I don't know why I got so angry, I shouldn't have, but I did. There was a comment that he made on the show when, at one point, I don't remember what the match was, it might have been the, I think Wade Barrett had a match. Did Wade Barrett have a match? There was some sort of core match, I forgot already. I think the core had a match. Booker T made a comment that he was talking about manager's license. See, this person either he had a manager's license or they needed a manager's license. And that was a gimmick going back. I mean, that gimmick goes back 30 years in wrestling at least, where when they actually had managers, they had, quote, manager licenses. If you didn't have a manager's license, you couldn't be at ringside. And they took it very seriously. And of course, there's no such thing as a manager's license. But here's Michael Cole after Booker T makes that comment, cutting him off, mocking him for pretending that it was still 1985, and basically blowing him off and talk about killing kayfabe. I mean, we know kayfabe has been dead in WWE for a while. You still try to maintain some sense of it. It's still fun to try to pretend that some of these things are real. And he just completely mocked him and just completely killed the whole fucking thing. And when he did that, I don't know why, but it pissed me off. So, fuck you, Michael Cole. Main event was Sheamus and Mark Henry in a tag match against Orton and Christian, who, by the way, seem to be BFFs. You know, they seem to be bosom buddies. I still say this is leading to a Christian heel turn at the pay-per-view or shortly thereafter. But they were fine. They got along well. They were best buds on this show. And they beat Sheamus and Mark Henry in the main event. So the two men that will challenge each other for the championship at Over the Limit, Christian gets his rematch, worked very well as tag team partners on SmackDown this week. And there were a couple of other things on the show, but those were really the only things worth mentioning. So, a fine wrestling show. Nothing outstanding, but another good show from the Friday Night Crew. So, thumbs up. Quick word here on the Lance Storm show. I gave a little review of World of Hurt, Episode 1, the first week. I actually went and posted a YouTube link that has since been taken down to the first episode. And I know some of you at least were able to watch it. And I think you enjoyed it. I again, think Tough Enough is a better show. But World of Hurt Episode 2, I had an opportunity to see this week. And again, you might be able to find it on YouTube unless it was taken down. It was much, much better to me than Episode 1. I just really enjoyed the show. This one, and it looks like this is going to be the formula of World of Hurt, where each episode will focus, for the most part, not that you won't see the other competitors training and all that, but it seems like each episode, unlike Tough Enough, will focus on one particular person. So that person, there'll be bits interspersed during the half an hour where, you know, they're sitting down. You get to learn more about who they are and how they're progressing. And at the end of the episode, when Landstorm gives his evaluation, he's giving his evaluation for that one person. So that's the formula this show follows. Again, there's no eliminations on this show. There's no contract or prize money or anything. It has something to do with Canadian law and money that they may have gotten, grant money to do the show that they would not have gotten if they actually had some sort of prize up for grabs, so they couldn't do it that way. But again, this episode was much better. It focused on the Prince of Perversion, this one guy on the show who didn't really show a whole lot of personality at first, and you know, Lance Storm is telling him, listen, you know, he's in the ring training with somebody, and he's just completely boring. And Lance Storm is saying, show me something. Show me something. The guy has to come up with some sort of character or personality. And so what he chooses to do is come up with a gimmick very similar to the original Goldust gimmick, which he's grinding up against his opponent. He's pretending to be gay, basically. Coming onto his opponents, doing this very, you know, cutting these very perverted promos, and it's just, it's entertaining as hell to see Lance Storm and everyone else's reaction to this character. It certainly creates controversy on this show. And it seems a bit forced to me. This guy, you know, he wants to make the character work in the worst way, but I get the sense that this is not the character for him. But goddammit, he's going to try. And it makes for an entertaining half an hour. The French Stallion is another contestant, I guess, for lack of a better term, on this show. By the way, all of these people have wrestling training. They've wrestled on the independents. Everybody on this show, I believe everybody, is a former student who trained with Lance Storm at his Storm Wrestling Academy. And when the producers of the show came to him about people, Lance actually handpicked these people to come back to be on the show. So it's not like these people are new to the wrestling industry, but I had never heard of the French Stallion before. This guy is amazing. I mean, he is, it's like he's almost always in character. I don't know what he's like in real life, but he is a phenomenal personality. And I, for one, cannot wait for the World of Hurt episode that focuses on the French fucking Stallion. I will be watching that episode without question. So, anyway, if you've had a chance to see it, great. perhaps you agree with me. I thought this was so much better than episode one. And I know most of you probably cannot or will not be able to see it. If you look hard enough online, you could probably find it. I know that Lance has said he's trying to get some sort of U.S. distribution. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that a U.S. cable network could pick the show up at some point, and you could see World of Hurt on TV here maybe later in the year. But he hasn't been able to do that as of yet. So if you could find it, check it out. Really good stuff. Much better than the first week. So that brings me to Impact on Thursday, which I did not have a chance to see. I was hoping to, and it didn't work out that way. So, wrestling matters. You heard me mention that earlier in the show. That seems to be TNA's new tagline, wrestling matters. And I saw the video. They put a video up on their website where they recorded comments from guys like Kurt Angle and James Storm and Robert Roode and AJ Styles backstage during the show on why wrestling matters to them. And it was good. I liked the fire that I saw. And since that time, they put up a whole bunch of individual 30-second videos with individual wrestlers, including the Pope, including Samoa Joe, and many others, asking them why wrestling matters to them. It's part of a new branding campaign by TNA that I mentioned before. I want to mention this here. I saw on the SE Scoops Facebook page a couple days ago where some people were complaining that the internet wrestling fans are being too cynical again, and we should be happy. This could be what turns TNA around. This could be the one thing that turns the company around. One person said that TNA was restructuring. But of course, everyone has to be so negative about it. Blah, 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 blah. So here's my take on this. First of all, you're right. Internet wrestling fans are generally very negative, very cynical, and very difficult to please. This is not news. This has been the case since the advent of the internet. If SE Scoops and Twitter and Facebook were around during the late 80s, I guarantee that we'd all be bitching about how Andre couldn't work, how Hogan's holding down all the young talent, and how goddamn terrible that match was on primetime wrestling between King Haku and Jim Powers, okay? Having said all of that, I think that person needs to brush up on his definition of what the word restructuring actually means. Okay, the basic definition is to, quote, organize something in a different manner, end quote. So let's be clear here. There is zero evidence that anything is actually changing behind the scenes in the organizational structure of TNA. Vince Russo, who does not love wrestling, in fact, I think he hates wrestling, Vince Russo is still writing their TV shows. Hulk Hogan, Eric Bischoff, and Dixie Carter are all still in positions of power in TNA. Dixie Carter is still the president of TNA. Now, if this results in more or longer wrestling matches on their shows, great. But the writing also needs to make sense, and they need to cut back on a lot of the stupid bullshit. All of those things together will help. But why should I believe them this time when they say that things are going to be different? How many times have we heard TNA say that things will never be the same, or change is coming, or the like? Nothing ever changes. Nothing ever changes. So yes, generally speaking, internet wrestling fans are overly negative, miserable people who have good reason to be overly negative and miserable. Okay? I'll use the bully analogy. I make it sound like I've used this analogy before. This is the first time I'm using it. If you're being picked on and bullied at school, and you wear your emotions on your sleeve and you let it get to you, they're going to keep bullying you because it gets a reaction out of you. But if you choose to ignore it and pretend that it doesn't bother you, more often than not, eventually they'll get bored and they'll move on to their next target. If you give these wrestling fans a better product, if you give them more of what they're asking for and can be consistent with it, cut out the bullshit, have things make sense, and give them good wrestling week after week, even if they still find something to complain about at first, you're going to shut them up pretty damn quickly. You're not going to be able to give them everything they want. You can't please everybody. But if you do those things, those are the key things right there. It will make a difference. It will help. You know, when TNA first started, they tried something to separate themselves from WWE. The X Division, in its infancy, was great. I mean, it was something that we had never seen before. It was like the WCW Cruiserweight division with the volume turned all the way up. And somewhere along the way, they made the decision that we want to try to be just like WWE. We're going to be WWE Lite. We're going to try their same brand of sports entertainment. And the thing is, there cannot be another WWE. You can't copy WWE and be as good as they are at what they do. The thing is, WWE can't even be WWE sometimes. And what I mean by that is, when WWE tries to be their own brand of sports entertainment, more often than not, it sucks. So even when WWE tries to be WWE, they stink. Why would you want to copy that? Why would you try to replicate that? This, if they're being honest with themselves, and they say wrestling matters, and they're going to go more in that direction, if they do the things that I mentioned, it could work. This could be the one thing that finally separates them from WWE and makes people say, you know what? Hey, this company's giving us a different type of product. Maybe I'll check it out. Instead of putting on Spike TV and seeing the product and saying, you know what? This is just a carbon copy of what I can see on USA Network with better production values. So for TNA's sake, I hope it works. Their Sacrifice pay-per-view, by the way, is tonight. As I'm recording this, again, I'm sure many of you will listen to this after the fact, but TNA has a pay-per-view tonight headlined by Sting defending the TNA Heavyweight Championship against Rob Van Dam and Kurt Angle teaming with China to take on Jeff and Karen Jarrett. Apparently there's some sort of angle, what I believe is an angle, going on Twitter where Karen says she had a fall and she injured her ankle and she posted a picture of her ankle with an ice pack over it. All I see is a leg with an ice pack on it. I don't see anything wrong in that photo, so I assume this is going somewhere and she's not really injured. I guess we'll see what happens. Now, the one other thing I just want to mention real quick about Impact, even though I didn't have a chance to watch it, I do read the reviews of the show so I can keep up on what's going on, even when I can't actually see every segment. And one of the things I saw was apparently they were really pushing a TNA heavyweight title match with Mr. Anderson as the number one contender. And I presume that Mr. Anderson is getting the next title shot at the June pay-per-view. Apparently, that's kind of what they were talking about at the end of the show when they went off the air for what was the go-home show to tonight's pay-per-view. So they were pushing Mr. Anderson as the title contender on a show that doesn't take place until next month. Why even have a fucking pay-per-view tonight? I'm being serious. Why not just skip this pay-per-view? I know the cable companies wouldn't be very happy. Put on a 2-hour Best of X Division special. That'll make people very happy. And just push the next pay-per-view. If you're going to have 6 weeks to build up the June pay-per-view show, if that's what you're going to do, why push a title match for the June show so hard 3 days before your pay-per-view this Sunday? I mean, I know they don't give a shit about people who buy their pay-per-views. Everything to them is about ratings. I'm being 100% dead honest. Ratings are a big deal to TNA. Why not put the Sting RVD title match on free TV and hype it up? And just push the Anderson-Sting match, or whoever the champion may be, for the next pay-per-view. Why do they do that? Why do they do that? It just drives me up a fucking wall. Another big story this week that I'll believe it when I see it, but it gives me hope. It's a positive story. And by the way, I'm so happy to hear... I'm going to talk about managers here, and I'm so happy to hear that they got their head out of their ass about managers after Larry Sweeney killed himself. That's great. But Wrestling Observer had an item in the newsletter earlier in the week that said that there were meetings of late where it was discussed about reviving the manager role for some heels in the WWE roster, some heels who may not be able to talk at main event level, which is probably 80% of them. Michael Hayes was paired off with Tyson Kidd. A lot of you were already aware of this. He came out with Kidd on Superstars, cut a promo before the match, and Tyson Kidd went on to beat Trent Beretta. So it looks as though, at first when I heard this from the tapings during the week, I thought, well, it doesn't necessarily mean that Michael Hayes is with Tyson Kidd. Perhaps they just put him with Kidd in that match as a test, kind of a test run to see how the crowd reacted and how Hayes did in the role, and then they're going to pair him off with somebody literally and figuratively bigger than Tyson Kidd. But apparently he's with Kidd, which is fine. I think Tyson Kidd is a hell of an athlete, but, you know, I don't know that... I can't see him as being somebody Vince McMahon is actually going to keep pushing beyond a couple of weeks. I just don't have any faith in it. Perhaps Hayes will manage people other than Tyson Kidd as well. Arn Anderson's name is another name that has been talked about potentially as being a manager. I think he would do a damn good job in that role. Yeah, the thing about Tyson Kidd is they must see something in him, because they originally paired him off with Jackson Andrews, you may remember, before they realized how green Jackson Andrews was, and they sent him right back down to FCW. So perhaps I'm wrong. Perhaps this is what Tyson Kidd needs to get to the next level, and he could be a solid mid to upper card, mid card talent who perhaps is in contention for the Intercontinental or the U.S. title, whatever brand he's on. I don't remember. I think he's on SmackDown. But I'm very, very happy to hear that they're at least talking about the possibility of bringing managers back. God knows I've crowed about this so many times on the show before. You know, the lost art of the wrestling manager. You're never going to find another Bobby Heenan. And to be honest, Larry Sweeney, who I talked about weeks ago on the show after he killed himself, was the one guy who I think really reminded me of a modern-day Bobby Heenan. But even Larry Sweeney, as good as he was in the role, there can never be another Bobby Heenan. But imagine all the other managers that have come and gone over the years, whether it was Jim Cornette, Paul Bearer, Jimmy Hart, Mr. Fuji. And, of course, you had a lot of valets as well. Sonny, who, of course, managed a couple of different pairs of tag team champions, was one of the more successful diva managers in WWE history. It's something that's missing from the product now. Again, it makes me really scratch my head when a guy like Jim Mitchell, who was the Sinister Minister in the original ECW, and he was a manager for Abyss years ago in TNA. Guy like him is sitting at home doing things other than being a wrestling manager, which seems like the role he was born to do. Why WWE doesn't pick up the phone and call a guy like that? I mean, there was a story last year, okay? And I remember hearing an interview with Jim Mitchell on a podcast where he talked about this. There was a tryout at FCW. I don't know if it was a wrestler tryout or if they actually announced some sort of manager tryout. They may have actually announced the manager tryout, but whatever it was, he decided that he was going to go down there. I think he had exchanged emails with Steve Kern, who runs the developmental promotion down there in Florida. And the point is, I think he showed up at the building and was told, first of all, they blew him off as though they didn't even know who he was. And then they said, well, it's $1,000. He actually had to pay money, and a lot of money. I mean, that's not an insignificant amount of money to look at. He actually had to pay them to try out. Here's a guy that's been in the wrestling business for years, off and on. And it was an insult. So at that point, he said, ah, forget it, and he went on with his life. And it just makes me shake my head. And if we had more people like that in wrestling, I guarantee you that more, I can't even just say heels. I think some baby faces would benefit from a manager as well, but probably more so, you know, monster heels who should not be talking, having somebody as their mouthpiece. You'd have a lot more guys over right now. I firmly believe that. I firmly believe that. I know we're never going to get back to the days of the old, you know, WWF where, I mean, talk about managers. For God's sake, you had Fred Blassie, Lou Albano, Bobby Heenan, Oliver Humperdinck, Jimmy Hart, Mr. Fuji, Slickster, Frenchie Martin with Dino Bravo, and Billy Graham was a manager for Don Morocco for some time, and probably a bunch of others that I'm just forgetting off the top of my head. And it was actually kind of funny because back then you'd have these bidding wars. Like for Bam Bam Bigelow, for example, when he first came to the WWF, right around 87, 88, and there was actually a bidding war. All the main managers wanted Bam Bam Bigelow, and they were sure that they were going to get him. They were all in the Bam Bam sweepstakes, and each week on the syndicated shows, they would announce another manager bites the dust, and they'd put a giant red X over their face when they found out that they were not going to be chosen as the manager of Bam Bam Bigelow. And ultimately, Oliver Humperdinck, who passed away fairly recently, got the nod. And Bam Bam really didn't go anywhere. I know he hurt his knee, and his run with Humperdinck was relatively brief. It was actually quite a fail. But I miss those days. You know, and managers are entertaining. You know, WWE is all about entertainment, all about comedy skits and all that kind of stuff. I don't understand why they don't do it more often. And finally, it looks as though they've come to their senses. But like I said at the beginning, I'll believe it when I see it. It's great that I can read this and that I see Michael Hayes on TV, or in this case on WWE.com, managing Tyson Kidd. You know, Hayes, by the way, for those who may have forgotten or weren't born at that point, which are many of you, was a manager for a time for the Hardy Boys. In fact, some people would say that it was him managing the Hardys back around 97 that helped get them over to the next level. He was always a big, big fan of the Hardys. And as the head writer on SmackDown, which Michael Hayes still is, you know, he wanted the Hardys on his brand. I think he was one of the driving forces behind the Matt Hardy version 1 push all those years ago, and he was a big fan of Jeff Hardy. So I want to see more of it, but I remain skeptical until I can really see something on television that makes me go, you know what? They actually brought managers back, and they're making a difference. But it's a step in the right direction. It's a step in the right direction. Kevin Nash, one other quick news bit here before I get to the mailbag. Kevin Nash had an interview about a week or so ago on Live Audio Wrestling, and he gave everybody an update on Scott Hall. And it's funny because I think it was last week I mentioned that no news was good news. I hadn't heard anything new on the Scott Hall story, and I think that same day or the very next day, there were stories about his ex-wife Dana confronting him, and Hall spit at her and, you know, told her to drop dead, and, you know, because she's... I don't want to get into the whole thing, but basically she has tried a lot over the last 13 or 14 years to get Scott Hall help, and he just doesn't seem to want it. And she's kind of reached her wit's end. She's reached out to Kevin Nash and Sean Waltman very publicly on Twitter. You can argue whether that's the appropriate measure to take or not, but she's desperate. You know, she wanted to help the guy. She didn't know where else to turn to. Kevin Nash has had to answer questions that he's gotten about it. In a way, I actually kind of feel sorry for Kevin Nash, just because, you know, Nash is one of, if not Scott Hall's best friend, and they've, you know, driven the roads together for years, going back to when they were Diesel and Razor, you know, in mid-90s WWF, and of course throughout their entire run in WCW and even post-WCW. And I believe in my heart of hearts that nobody wants to see Scott Hall get better, more so than Kevin Nash. And for Nash to have to, you know, answer to these tweets from Hall's ex-wife and get tweets from other people. And Nash is very emotional, and Nash is one of those guys that I think will drink at midnight and will post tweets that perhaps he regrets posting. So he wears his heart on his sleeve, and he'll post sometimes and say, listen, people, leave me the fuck alone, because he has people that say to him, oh, why aren't you doing more? Why aren't you doing more to help Scott Hall? What is he, his fucking father? Are they fucking Siamese twins attached at the hip? How much can the guy possibly do? The guy is, you know, Kevin Nash has a family of his own. He has a life of his own and a family of his own, and I sympathize with the guy. The guy doesn't deserve that kind of bullshit. I believe he's doing everything in his power to try to help his friend out. But he's not his legal guardian. He's not responsible for Scott Hall. Leave the guy alone. But the one thing I will say about Nash, he mentioned something that made me laugh. He mentioned on the show that he had received an email, you know, being that he's a WWE legend now under contract, he had gotten an email that mentioned that Lex Luger is now, quote, running WWE's wellness policy, which made me laugh. I must have laughed for like 20 seconds straight. Now, I know Luger has said that he is in some way assisting WWE, I think, with wellness or nutrition. That may well be. And in fact, I don't think that's such a horrible idea. Lex Luger is, in a way, is one of the poster children. I won't say the poster child, because you have somebody like Hogan, but Luger is one of the poster children for steroid use and abuse in wrestling. He admits it, you know. He abused steroids and growth hormone and all those different things. And if you look at Lex now, he's had a lot of health issues over the years. He's found God. He seems like he's gotten his life back on track, but he's a shell physically. He's a shell of his former self. He's had a lot of problems. Who better to talk about the dangers of getting into that sort of stuff than a guy that was there, and when you look at him, is a prime example of what happens when you get into the wrong kind of thing. So in a way, I don't think it's so horrible to, in some way, have Lex Luger on board to, whether it's, you know, having seminars or giving advice to the younger wrestlers or, you know, being part of it in some way. But the insinuation that Lex Luger is running or in charge of WWE's wellness policy, it's bullshit. Don't believe it. It's bullshit. I'm sure Nash, you know, I don't know why Nash would say that. Perhaps Nash got an email of some kind mentioning Lex's involvement and he misunderstood. You know, he got the email, supposedly. I didn't. But Lex Luger ain't in charge of the WWE wellness policy. That ain't... Something don't smell right when it comes to that. So, I got one email. I only got one email about it earlier in the week, but still, I had to mention it because when I heard it, it made me laugh. the idea that he would be in charge. He'd be the head of the anti-drug and steroid policy that WWE has, although he is a great person to talk about it, is a fucking joke. So I don't believe everything you hear. All right, so we're going to get into the mailbag here. I just want to give a quick shout-out, first and foremost, to Justin Santiago, one of the fans of the Sound Off and one of my loyal posters on Facebook. So he's celebrating a birthday today, so happy birthday, Justin. And by the way, if you're not on Facebook already, what the hell are you waiting for? Facebook.com/TheSolomonster. It's like a little community. People post there more than I do. And it's a nice group of people there. So why not become part of that? Facebook.com/TheSolomonster, Twitter.com/Solomonster, where I will post updates often, sometimes about wrestling, sometimes not. So just a quick word to get on there if you are not already. It's free. It doesn't cost you anything. And I got a ton of emails from you guys, which I was happy to get since I requested them, asking you, how did you become a wrestling fan? Share with me stories of how, when, why you became a fan of professional wrestling. I got a bunch of emails from you guys, and I think what I'm going to do is I'll continue to share them, but only a little bit each week. I've gotten so many of them that I can't possibly get to them all in one show. So I'm going to share some more of those stories this week, and whatever I don't get to, I'll try to get to next week. And in the meantime, again, feel free to email me. I know I haven't heard from all of you yet, so again, if you want to share with me, if you remember even vaguely how and when you became a wrestling fan, email me at thesolomonster@gmail.com, and I will try to, at some point in the next couple of weeks, share them on the air. I did mention explicitly on the show last week that if you want to possibly get them read on the air, I'm going to try to get to as many of them as I can. The only way to possibly have them read on the air is to email them to me. And I still got a whole bunch from people on Facebook, and that's great, and I read everything you guys send me, but if you sent something to me on Facebook about how you became a wrestling fan, it ain't going to get read on the show. It's just not going to happen. I need everything organized in one place, or else this show does not run smoothly. So if you want to resend it, feel free, but I do read everything you guys send me in terms of emails and private messages, but I'm only sharing the ones that are emailed to me, so I just wanted to mention that. All right, now with that out of the way, let me get to some questions first, and I'll get to the rest of your stories at the end. So let's get into it here. I got a letter from Pete. I believe it was Pete. Where's his email here? He was asking me if WWE has any concrete plans at this point for SummerSlam. I think I mentioned last week WWE wants The Rock on the show. It's going to basically come down to his scheduling. And the original SummerSlam plan was for John Cena to defend the championship against Alberto Del Rio, but Del Rio has had plans changed on him so many times at this point that I don't even know if it's going to happen at SummerSlam. It's going to happen at some point. That's why he got moved over to Raw. It could happen at SummerSlam. It's a big enough match where it should. I certainly don't want to see John Cena versus The Miz, you know, part 14. But what I mean is it could actually end up being before SummerSlam. But the other thing is, and I don't know that it's been reported widely or anything, but for anybody who's followed Roddy Piper of late on Twitter, he has mentioned before, and now he's mentioned it again recently, that he has pitched an idea, and he actually pitched an idea before WrestleMania to WWE, but it was already too late at that point, to do a Piper's Pit with John Cena and The Rock. So, if WWE can actually get Rock on the show in August at SummerSlam, he's pitching the idea and lobbying to have Piper's Pit again. I say, why not do it at SummerSlam? You know, Cena's still going to wrestle in the main event no matter what, of course, but I don't see why you can't do the segment, let's say, midway through the show. Sell a few extra pay-per-views with it. I'm sure there are people out there who would love to see Piper's Pit with Cena and The Rock, or any sort of interaction between Rock and Piper, which I don't think we've ever had before, at least not on TV, would be phenomenal. I would pay money to see that. So, just an idea, just a thought, if you're WWE. All right, let's see here. Craig writes in, he wants to know if there's any match types or stipulations in WWE that have never taken place that I would like to see. War Games. It's still the one match type that has been done before, not just in WCW even. Other smaller promotions have done it, even if they haven't called it War Games. But I want to see a War Games match in WWE. I really do. I still say Elimination Chamber is a poor man's version of War Games. You know, War Games with two rings, side by side, 5-on-5, inside a cage. That's what I would love to see. I think you can use that. You know, Survivor Series has really fallen to the wayside as one of the, quote, big four pay-per-views each year, to the point where Vince McMahon almost eliminated Survivor Series in, well, I guess, last year before he changed his mind. He may eliminate it again. Supposedly, Survivor Series this year was on the chopping block again. You're not going to do Survivor Series elimination matches anymore, at least not more than one or two. If that's the case, that's fine. I could actually see where that would be a dated concept. Why not promote a War Games match as the main event of Survivor Series? Raw vs. SmackDown, 5-on-5. Five of your best guys from both brands going head-to-head in a War Games match with two rings in the main event of Survivor Series. You want a match to help make Survivor Series feel special and get more people to spend their money on the pay-per-view? There you go. Plus, it fits. Survivor Series, War Games. It makes sense. Now, I know if you do a match like that, it eliminates the need to do a match of bragging rights between the two brands, but who cares? Nobody gives a fuck about bragging rights. Just eliminate it. There's more money to be made in War Games at Survivor Series. I guarantee you there's more money to be made if you do it that way. So, War Games, that's the only match. I mean, years ago, I used to say that, oh, I would love to see a scaffold match in WWE, but a little older, a little wiser, I don't want to see a scaffold match in WWE. Scaffold matches actually suck. If you've ever seen a scaffold match before, people are so petrified to be up there on that scaffold. You can't possibly have a good wrestling match up there. And the element of danger is just so high. Why take the risk? WWE can ill afford to lose any more bodies. Sure, let's put them 25 feet in the air in a scaffold match. Yeah, not a good idea. So years ago, I thought, you know, I would love to see that in WWE. Now, not so much. As far as all those other hardcore match types, you know, light tube matches and all that, that's not wrestling. That's bullshit. I'm sorry. I know some people like it. Whatever floats your boat. You're always going to have an independent promotion out there that does that kind of stuff. They get off on that kind of stuff. It's what people want to see. I don't know why you would want to see that, but that's fine. If you want to have a match where you smash light tubes over people's heads and you slam people down on light tubes and slice them open, fine. I don't see what that has to do with wrestling. I think it's stupid. I think it's bullshit. But hey, some people like it. Good for them. But I don't ever want to see something like that in a WWE ring. Francisco writes in, Francisco Rodriguez. That's interesting. Do you happen to pitch for the New York Mets? Says, Dear Solomon, so with the recent feats of strength shown by Ezekiel Jackson and Mason Ryan this past week, it makes me wonder, what are some of the biggest displays of strength you've ever seen in professional wrestling? Well, let's see here. I have to say the number one thing that jumps into my mind would probably be the first time I ever saw Brock Lesnar pick up the Big Show for the F5. Actually, that whole match they had at the 2002 Survivor Series, Madison Square Garden, the night that Brock lost his first match, which I still disagree with, he was throwing Big Show around like he was a lightweight. I mean, he gave Big Show an overhead belly-to-belly suplex. He gave him a German, I think a released German suplex. It's no wonder Brock and Big Show were so goddamn injured and beat up at the end of their feud. But when he picked Big Show up on his shoulders and held him up there for the F5, you could see people in the background. They were in awe. I mean, they were standing up. They were, flash bulbs were going off. They couldn't believe it. And he delivered the F5. And remember, Brock was still a heel, although he was kind of turning babyface in that he was starting to go against Paul Heyman. Paul would give him instructions, and Lesnar was like an uncontrolled beast. And I guess in storyline, that was part of the reason Heyman turned on Brock and went with Big Show, because he felt he had created a monster he could no longer control. But the crowd went apeshit for it. It was an unbelievable feat of strength. And even when he would do it to Big Show afterwards, even though we had already seen it, it was amazing to me every single time that he could hold that amount of weight up on his shoulders with ease and then flip him in the air and slam him down. It was amazing. It truly was unbelievable. The other one that comes to mind would probably be Bill Goldberg in WCW. You know, the first time I saw Bill Goldberg, ironically, to Big Show when he was the Giant, give him a jackhammer. Hold him up there for a few seconds, and just getting him up there, let alone holding him up there for 3 or 4 or 5 seconds, it just amazes me. Even to this day, if I watch a clip of it on YouTube, place goes apeshit. Why not? I mean, they knew they were witnessing something special at the time. And when he jackhammered Big Show, when he jackhammered Ron Reese, who was another Giant guy, although not as big as the Giant, Bill Goldberg was a scary, strong dude. Nobody will ever take that away from him. Maybe not the best wrestler in the world, but he didn't have to be. You know, Goldberg didn't get over because of his technical prowess. Goldberg got over because he was a monster. He would go in the ring, he would beat you up, he would spear you, he would jackhammer you, and he would leave. And it didn't matter if you were the smallest guy in the roster or the biggest guy in the roster. The bigger they are, the harder they fall. When he got Big Show up for the jackhammer that first time, whew, that was impressive. That was impressive. You could say Hogan Andre at WrestleMania 3, but I wouldn't even go that far. It was a moment that will be remembered forever. It will be replayed in the highlight reel until the day we all die, until the day that wrestling dies, until the day that Hogan dies. But Hogan had slammed Andre. In fact, a lot of people had slammed Andre the Giant before that. Andre, at that point, probably was legitimately at his biggest weight. He was not in the best of shape in more ways than one. And Hogan picked him up and he slammed him down. It was impressive. He didn't hold Andre up there like, you know, Big Zeke did recently with Big Show, but it was still more of a body slam than what Lex Luger, for example, gave Yokozuna. You know, I'll give Lex credit. He was a strong guy, but I can't say Luger slamming Yokozuna on the Intrepid is like an all-time great feat of strength, because let's be honest, it was more of a hip toss than anything else. I mean, really, go back and watch that. He got him up, he slammed him down. It was not a full rotation body slam, so I'm not going to put that on my list. But yeah, Brock and Big Show, that stuff, and then Goldberg, very, very impressive stuff. Luis wants to know about The Undertaker, now that he seems to be looking towards retirement, as if we haven't heard that a bazillion times in the last 10 years. Do you think WWE will attempt to go ahead with a John Cena match soon? Do you think this is more likely for Survivor Series, since WrestleMania 28 is already locked up with Cena vs. Rock, potentially, and Undertaker against Triple H Part 2? For what it's worth, I don't expect Undertaker vs. Triple H again at WrestleMania. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't assume that's the match we're going to get. As far as Survivor Series, selfishly, I would love to see it only because it's Madison Square Garden. I hope to be at Survivor Series. Having said that, I don't know why you would even ask this question. The whole allure of The Undertaker versus John Cena is not them having a match. It's them having a match at WrestleMania. If the match is not at WrestleMania, then who gives a fuck about Undertaker versus John Cena? The whole point is that John Cena is the one guy, and not everybody would agree with this, but anybody out there who thinks that they can enjoy an Undertaker WrestleMania match and, depending on the opponent, could potentially buy into the fact that, hey, this guy could beat him. Some people just refuse to believe it. They don't think Undertaker will ever lose. I don't think he's going to lose either. But that doesn't mean that when he fought Triple H, you know, my heart didn't skip a beat as a fan when, you know, he tombstoned Undertaker and went for the pin, for example. It's moments like that that are special. And I think John Cena is the only guy on the WWE roster worth a damn who could give you that kind of a match with The Undertaker at WrestleMania. And Cena, of course, Super Cena, he wins many of his matches. I mean, you don't need me to tell you that. That's one of the things people hate him for. Him and Orton are seemingly two unbeatable forces on the roster. If you're going to do the match, it has to be at WrestleMania. I mean, what good is it if you have Undertaker versus John Cena at Survivor Series? It's a big match, yeah, but it doesn't mean as much. And Undertaker is so beat up, I don't see him wrestling on any pay-per-views between now and WrestleMania. I mean, it's possible. I haven't heard that definitively, but he's in a bad way. Physically, he is really reaching the end of his rope. And his shoulder, I've mentioned it before, he has a shoulder that is injured and cannot heal fully. It's never going to be 100% again. Why waste an Undertaker match on a pay-per-view not named WrestleMania? I mean, it really doesn't make any sense. So, I think the question shouldn't even be asking this question. If it's not WrestleMania, then who the hell cares about Cena versus Undertaker? Now, Cena's locked up with Rock. Okay, fine. What about the idea of holding off on an Undertaker WrestleMania match until WrestleMania 30? It's hard to predict what will be happening and where you're going to be in 3 years. But if Undertaker is that beat up, if Undertaker is that hurt, you know, you can skip WrestleMania 28. You can skip WrestleMania 29. If WrestleMania 30 is your big show, it comes back to the Garden where it all began, it's a big, big deal. You know, potentially, maybe save The Undertaker for WrestleMania 30. You know, let his injuries heal up a little bit more. Fuck, the guy will have 2 or 3 years to get healthy. He can have that one last match where he tries to go 20-0 at WrestleMania 30, and you can potentially do the John Cena match at that show, in the Garden, where I'm sure everybody and their mother would be against John Cena. You know, there's nothing that says Undertaker, you know, can't skip a WrestleMania show and it breaks the streak. Streak doesn't break. He doesn't lose. That's another idea. I've had people email me with the same thing. I agree. I'm not saying I would do it. I'm saying it's an idea that's worth thinking about, especially if Undertaker is that beat up. Why feel obligated to get him on every single WrestleMania show? I know they want to. It's a good marketing gimmick. You can have your main events and an Undertaker match to promote. But, I don't know, just throwing it out there. I mean, I really don't see the sense in Undertaker going 21-0 or 22-0. I would say when he goes 20-0, that's probably going to be it for him. Brian wants to know why WWE has not yet put Owen Hart in their Hall of Fame. It has to do with his widow, Martha, who is not a fan of WWE and is not a fan of WWE seemingly paying tribute of any kind to Owen. She had taken issue even with him being on their DVD releases and such, and putting him in the Hall of Fame would be pretty... It would be a difficult thing for them to do right now. I'm sure at some point they probably will, but those wounds are not healed, and it's not the sort of publicity that the company wants if they try to put him in their Hall of Fame and his ex-wife, or not ex-wife, but his widow, I should say, is adamantly against it and goes to the media and says that she finds this to be disrespectful and all that. It's not a headache. It's not a battle that WWE needs right now. And that's the only reason I think that he hasn't been put in already. I'm sure they would love to put him in there. There's people in the Hall of Fame, in my opinion, far less deserving than Owen Hart. Even though Owen was never a world champion, it's not a criteria for being in the Hall. Owen absolutely deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. He's been part of some of the best matches and best entertaining feuds. You know, that brother versus brother rivalry in WWE is one of the best. Intercontinental champion, multiple time tag team champion, European champion, King of the Ring. No reason for Owen not to be in there. Has everything to do with his widow. That's the only reason he's not in right now. Steve writes in, Dear Solid Monster, what is your opinion of Christy Hemme's work as the new ring announcer in TNA? Since in that environment she seems to do a good job, just wanted to know what you think. I'm not familiar with her work as a ring announcer. I know her as a backstage interviewer in TNA where, you know, I think she was fine in the role. She didn't offend me or blow me away or anything like that. As a ring announcer, I haven't heard her work, so I can't really judge it because I haven't seen her. Kyle from San Antonio has a question regarding John Cena. He says he's constantly seen people throw John Cena in with Randy Orton and Triple H as guys who go out of their way backstage to bury people. I wonder if you've heard any stories that justify this, because for the life of me, I never remember hearing anybody say one bad thing about John Cena backstage. In fact, I've heard on multiple occasions that John has gotten guys pushes using his backstage influence and putting young guys over in interviews. Here's the thing about John Cena. John Cena has done more for people backstage than he has against them. I agree with that. John Cena is the one that supposedly went to Vince McMahon last year when Evan Bourne got that little bit of a push on Raw, which, of course, was killed dead within a couple of weeks. But you can't really blame John Cena for that. But Cena is the one that went to Vince and said, listen, we got to do something with this guy. And shortly thereafter, we saw Evan Bourne actually rattle off some wins. He had a big tag match on Raw in the main event where he teamed up with John Cena and got the pin, I believe. And Cena's put other guys over in interviews. He does that a lot, which he should. As the face of the company going out there in the media all the time, you should say good things about the talent on your roster and put the product over. Cena gets a bad rap when it comes to that stuff. I, too, have never heard of any stories of him burying people. The only time I've ever heard a story of Cena saying a bad word about somebody backstage that could possibly get that person in hot water was Kennedy. You know, Cena was not a fan of working with Mr. Kennedy, but Cena was not the only one who went to management to complain about him. Shawn Michaels complained to management, Triple H complained to management, Undertaker supposedly complained to management, Randy Orton, of course. I mean, he chewed him out backstage in front of everybody, claimed that it was unsafe working with him. And shortly thereafter, Kennedy was gone from WWE. So that would be the only time I could ever recall John Cena not even so much burying somebody, but, you know, voicing his displeasure with working with somebody behind the scenes. All right, Joey writes in. He has been a listener since episode 140. I went to the May 10th SmackDown tapings, and during the breaks on the show, they were showing different things on the TitanTron, and on the thing above the TitanTron, it had World Wrestling Entertainment. Could you explain why? Because I thought they were no longer World Wrestling Entertainment. They were just WWE. Well, it's going to take them a while to get rid of that stuff. I mean, you're gonna see that. And for all I know, they may not do away with that. You know, on certain pieces of equipment, if it says World Wrestling Entertainment, it may cost them more to put a new decal over it or somehow edit it out or airbrush it than it would to just keep it there. But it was a decision that was made only within the last couple of weeks. And it's going to take some time before all of their stationery, for example, and all of those different types of things have World Wrestling Entertainment taken out of it. So I bet if you even look at the copyrights of some of the programming and whatnot, it'll probably still say World Wrestling Entertainment for a time until they filter all that stuff out. So you got to give them a little break for a little while because it takes a while to rebrand and get that stuff out of there. I mean, I'm sure they had the same problem when they went from being WWF to WWE. It wasn't like you snapped your fingers and everything was WWE overnight. It takes time. Brandon from Iowa Park, Texas writes in, a listener since episode 145. His question this week involves the Dynamite Kid, Tom Billington. He recently read Bret Hart's autobiography and got a really good idea of what type of person, as well as what type of worker he was. But Bret said that he and Tom, Dynamite, had some of the best matches of his career in Stu Hart Stampede Wrestling, based out of Calgary, as well as in the WWF, when the Hart Foundation feuded with the Bulldogs. Late in his career, after his ruptured disc injuries and all the years of steroid, painkiller, alcohol, and cocaine abuse caught up with him, he went on sort of a mean streak, calling people out and just becoming a genuine dickhead. He teased a former Golden Gloves boxer who was currently injured and said, "Come and see me." Blah, blah, blah. Let's see here. Soon after, the victim punched Billington in the mouth with a loaded fist with a roll of quarters three times, knocking out his front teeth. Well, first of all, as I understand it, the person who nailed Dynamite backstage with a roll of quarters and knocked out his teeth was Jacques Rougeau, or the former Mountie. This was back when Jacques was part of the fabulous Rougeau brothers with Ray. There was a big, big, big problem backstage with the Rougeaus and the Bulldogs, and more specifically, Jacques and Dynamite. Because the thing about Dynamite is, it wasn't as though Dynamite was such a wonderful person early in his career, and then something happened, and he got hurt, and so he became a dickhead. By all accounts and all stories that people have shared, Dynamite was always a dickhead, at least in the WWF, even before he got hurt. The Bulldogs were notorious for pulling ribs on people, which was more common, I think, back then than it is now. And a rib, again, is just a prank. It's a practical joke. A lot of times, I think wrestlers do it, really. Sometimes they're just dicks, but sometimes it's also to kind of weed out the men from the boys. Some people can take it, some people can't. You know, Billy Silverman was a former WCW referee who came over after the invasion, in 01, to work for the WWF. And he was also hazed and bullied, especially by Bradshaw. And I don't know that they ever did anything to Billy Silverman that was really awful. I mean, they certainly didn't do anything to him that was any worse than the worst rib I've ever heard before. But he couldn't take it. And he complained, and he quit the company. And some people can take it, and some people can't. But I believe that was the person who clocked him with a roll of quarters. It wasn't just some random person or anything like that. I believe it was Jacques. Who just said, "Enough's enough, and I'm going to get this guy." And I don't think too many people were upset when he did that either. And he didn't get fired. So, I mean, that tells you right there. The Rougeaus and Jacques were very highly regarded by Vince McMahon and WWE at the time, and I think they knew what was going on. And sometimes you just got to stand up for yourself and do what you got to do. But Dynamite, every story I've ever heard about him, he was an asshole. He was just not a nice guy. And like I said, they pulled ribs on a lot of people, but they were very mean-spirited. So, for example, you know, people would come back from a match to the dressing room and find their clothes being burned, for example, or destroyed. And to me, that's not a rib. You know, that's not a practical joke. A practical joke, which Kurt Hennig, for example, was notorious for, is taking somebody's suitcase with all their gear and somehow hoisting it up to the very top of the ceiling of the arena. And, you know, the person then is like, "Oh, great." You know, they got to find a way to get their luggage down from, you know, 100 feet up. It's on the roof. To me, a practical joke is not taking somebody's personal shit and just destroying it. You know, that's just being a fucking dick. So that is a pretty good indicator of the kind of person Dynamite Kid is. He just was not very well liked by too many people. As far as the kind of worker he was and all that, by the way, The injury that really changed his career, he was never the same after it. It was a ruptured disc in his back, and it was, you might think, well, maybe he suffered it on a big move or something during a match. Quite the contrary. If you go on YouTube, I don't remember what to type in to find it, but I've seen the video before. I'm sure it's still on YouTube. There's actually footage of the house show match from 1986. It was, I believe it was the Bulldogs against, I forgot who it was. It could have been the Dream Team, maybe Valentine and Beefcake. I think Dino Bravo maybe was in a match. But you see the footage in the YouTube clip. Dynamite, I believe, is tagged in, and when the injury happened, he was coming off the ropes. And when he came off the ropes, I believe he just went to jump over his opponent who was laying flat on the mat. So the person drops down, and you jump over them. And I believe that's what happened. Dynamite jumped over him, and even before Dynamite went to hit the ropes again, or at the moment that he hit the ropes, he froze. You could tell that was the moment that the injury took place, and he just crumples to the mat in a heap. And at first, nobody knows that he's hurt, let alone hurt as badly as he was. So I think they keep kicking at him and stomping, but at that point, he was immobile. He couldn't do anything. So it was a completely freak thing. I think it may have happened before he even hit the ropes, but let's just say he hit the ropes. That's how the injury happened. Now, it was building and building and building. He wrestled such a hard style. It wasn't like that's what caused the injury. That was a culmination of what ultimately caused the injury. But you would watch this tag match on YouTube and think to yourself, God damn, that's how he got hurt? It looks like nothing happened. But again, keep in mind, and Brandon goes on to ask me in his question here, can I tell him what kind of worker Dynamite Kid was? And he asks, how does Dynamite Kid compare to the style of Chris Benoit or Owen Hart? And I think it's ironic that you ask the question that way, because the way you ask the question, it's almost like, well, did Benoit wrestle a similar style to Dynamite? Benoit and Dynamite were friends. Benoit emulated Dynamite Kid throughout his entire career. He wanted to be the next Dynamite Kid. I think they met up in Stampede, and there's pictures of them together when they were both younger. And if you watch the style of a Chris Benoit match, he is like carbon copy of the Dynamite Kid. I mean, it's eerie how similar their styles are. The person who closest reminds me of Benoit or Dynamite Kid in modern-day pro wrestling in terms of their size, because, you know, Dynamite was a small guy, Benoit was a small guy. In terms of their size and in terms of the style and their mannerisms and their movement, Davey Richards on the independent circuit, who also wrestles for Ring of Honor, Davey Richards reminds me a lot of Chris Benoit or Dynamite Kid. Dynamite Kid wrestled a very physical style of professional wrestling. And he did a lot of things in the ring where he would put his body on the line, perhaps unnecessarily, and ultimately it cost him his career. That's what led to the back injury, where he did wrestle again after that, but I don't think he was ever the same. For all intents and purposes, his career ended with that back injury. And you know, as far as what he turned into later in his life, you know, he threatened his wife with a shotgun. He was just not a pleasant person to be around. And the story about his wife bought him a one-way plane ticket to the UK and said, you take this, you leave here, you don't come back. And that's what he did. He took the plane ticket. He went to the UK. I don't know that he's ever been back to the States. I don't know that he's ever left the UK since then. Ultimately, because of his injuries, he was relegated to a wheelchair. There was some sort of documentary. I don't know if it was on him or if he was part of it. They actually found him years ago, and they sent a camera to interview him. And again, he's a pathetic shell of his former self. And I don't know what the issue was. He had a steel toe, which I thought was a little weird. I'm not sure if that was because of an injury, if the toe rotted away. I don't know what that was all about. But yeah, Dynamite Kid is it's a sad story. You know, he had a book that came out many years ago that supposedly was good. It's a good book to read. Again, believe what you will from it. I'm sure he must tell stories in that book that are probably dubious at best, but it's still a pretty good book based on all the reviews. I've never read the book myself. I hope to do so at some point. So you might want to check that out. That'll give you a little bit of a better sense of the kind of performer he was, but just very physical, doing a lot of high-flying type maneuvers and, you know, top rope headbutts and stuff like that years and years and years before guys like Chris Benoit were doing it. And in fact, the only reason people like Benoit did it was because they were emulating that style. There's good and bad. Was that a good thing or a bad thing? Was Dynamite better for professional wrestling or worse for it? Because of the people who emulated that style. And again, Benoit wrestled a very hard style just like Dynamite and suffered a lot of injuries. And, you know, did that play a role in the end of Benoit's life? I'm sure to some degree it must have. I'm not going to blame what happened, you know. I'm not going to make such a comparison to say that, well, you see, Dynamite Kid really is the reason that Chris Benoit killed his family. I'm not going to go that far, but it was a very physical style that took a toll on his body and led to the premature end of his career. And he had a lot of great matches. I mean, if you want to go on YouTube and find them, they're out there. You know, those Bulldog tag matches from the mid to late 80s are some of the best tag matches you're ever going to see. And it's a shame. It really is a shame how his life ended up. All right, so let's get into some more stories that you guys have sent me on how you became a professional wrestling fan. A lot of different stories, people growing up in different eras, just very interesting stuff. So again, if you haven't emailed me yet, you can still email me. I'm going to probably be sharing these stories over the next couple of weeks. I'm not going to get to everything today, but I figured let's get to a couple more right now. And by the way, if you do email me and want them to possibly be read on the air, try to keep them pithy if you can. If it's really, really long, I mean, it's interesting for me to read, but I'm not going to read something that long on the air. So just try to keep them pithy if you can. This one comes from Sarab. Hope I'm pronouncing that right. One of our usual listeners from Bangalore, India. Being an Indian wrestling fan, we only started getting WWF programming around 1992. I don't remember if it was on bootleg VHS or on cable, but the first wrestling match I remember watching was WrestleMania 9. Bret Hart versus Yokozuna, Hulk Hogan then winning the championship belt at the end. I remember in the mid-90s, Bret Hart was the most popular star in India. That is, by the way, true. I don't know why, but Bret Hart was most over with people in Germany and India. When he would go to those places when he was the champ in the mid-90s, they went batshit crazy for him. So that is true. Anyway, all of my classmates would come to school wearing the Bret Hart shades and trading wrestling cards, and was everyone's hobby. I obviously started out as a Bret Hart fan, then stopped watching wrestling during the beginning of the Attitude Era because I thought my parents wouldn't allow me to watch the raunchy stuff. I finally started watching it again in late 98, by the time Rock and Austin were the top guys, and even started watching some WCW stuff, though Nitro was shown at least 2 months late here. That was the time wrestling's popularity exploded here, just like everywhere else, and loads of Indian fans used to think WCW was like a retirement home for WWF wrestlers. Well, it really was. I'm not going to lie. They had a lot of young guys, too, but WCW was very much like a retirement home for old WWF wrestlers. It just happens that at the time, people wanted to pay to see those people in the retirement home, and that's why Nitro kicked Raw's ass for 82 weeks in the ratings. So, there you go. Eric from New Jersey. Hey, Solomonster, I've been a wrestling fan almost my entire life. My grandmother bought me an Ultimate Warrior action figure when I was 2 years old, and I kept it my whole life. That is, until last month when I placed it in her coffin at her funeral. That toy made me want to watch wrestling, and I loved the Ultimate Warrior as a kid. I really became a hardcore fan in late 1996 when I was just 6 years old. My first real memory of wrestling is the Boiler Room Brawl between The Undertaker and Mankind. I was a big Taker fan and was scared to death of Mankind. I've seen every single Royal Rumble, WrestleMania, SummerSlam, and Survivor Series since that time. I think I came into wrestling at an ideal time when wrestling replaced eating your vitamins and saying your prayers. Through all the stress and hardships life can offer, wrestling still gives me the same joy it did when I was that little six-year-old boy watching my heroes like Bret Hart. Even though it may frustrate me at times, I still love it. No matter what is going on, my father and I can always talk wrestling and always have that connection. That is a very special thing to me. Thank you, Eric. That was a great letter. Jake from Long Island, New York. I became a wrestling fan because one of my best friends, who is a huge fan, he started watching in late 2007, and he put it on when we were hanging out, and I thought it was okay, but never was really that interested in it. Then he got the Tombstone Undertaker DVD, and I watched some of his classic matches with Kane and the infamous Hell in a Cell match with Mankind and became a casual fan at that point. I didn't start watching wrestling full-time until I flipped to an episode of Raw and decided to watch. The only thing I remember was Triple H and Randy Orton in the opening segment and Mr. Kennedy getting William Regal fired as the Raw General Manager. Actually, that might have been, now that I think about it, I think I might remember that episode. Believe it or not. That probably was the show where, Regal lost because I think he had gotten popped on a wellness violation. I think he had been suspended. That was when Regal was the GM. He was on a roll. He was coming out every week. He would have the lights turned out on the fans just to piss them off. And they had plans for him, and then I think he fucked up. And they had him lose, and that was the end of it. So I'm pretty sure that was the show. Anyway, he said also the feud with Edge and Undertaker, who was and still is my favorite wrestler, got me hooked, and I've been a huge wrestling fan ever since. So thank you, Jake. Edward from Houston, Texas. My earliest memory was in WCW when Sting was in the ring, I believe, and out of nowhere, a bunch of copycats came out that looked just like him. I was about 7 or 8 years old, and I became a fan, officially a fan, when the Ministry storyline was going on in WWF, and they showed Big Boss Man on the cross hanging. Well, remember, it wasn't a cross. WWE said it was not a cross. It was a symbol, you see. And actually, that Sting moment in WCW is one of the all-time great WCW moments from that era. I think I might have even talked about that on this show recently. You can find it on YouTube. Back then, Nitro would go off the air every week with an NWO beatdown. I mean, it was the same formula every single week. I mean, at the time, I guess it was fun and exciting, but you watch those old episodes of Nitro now on 24/7 when they air an episode of Raw and an episode of Nitro from the same week. They're going back through the Monday Night Wars, and it really strikes you all these years later how much they recycled and replayed the same goddamn angle every single week on TV. It was the same shit every week. Every week you'd have a main event. Every week you'd have an NWO beatdown. Maybe Sting would come out, maybe he wouldn't. It was the same shit all the time. But on this particular week, what happened was, again, Sting was the crow. This was when he wasn't speaking. They were building to the inevitable Sting vs. Hogan match. One of the best build-ups to a match, I'll give Eric Bischoff credit, that I've ever seen. And they had Stings, people looking like Sting with the black trench coat and the black and white makeup coming from all over the arena. They were coming out of the crowd. They were coming from the aisleway, from around the aisleway. And one of the Stings, who was coming down the aisle with two other ones at the time, just casually walked up the ring steps into the ring. The NWO, of course, was in the ring after one of their trademark beatdowns. And this particular Sting walked into the ring, and Buff Bagwell gave him a punch, and then he went to pose. Only this time, Sting didn't go down. And the crowd knew at that point. When he no-sold the punch and just stood there, the crowd went crazy. And he grabbed Buff from behind and put him in the Scorpion Death Drop position and slammed him down. And then, actually, what helped sell this angle was all of the Stings that were coming out of the crowd and to the ring were wearing Sting masks. WCW was selling this very basic white mask at the time that they probably made a lot of money off of. And all of the Stings were wearing masks, including this one. And what happened is he gave Buff the Scorpion Death Drop and then ripped the mask off. And at that point, the crowd just exploded. And he cleaned house. One man beat the shit out of all of the NWO members at that point. But that was a pretty memorable angle. So if I were growing up at the time and that was the first thing I saw, that's something I probably would not forget. Edsel writes in, longtime listener. Became a wrestling fan about 13 years ago. When WWE had their Rock Bottom In Your House pay-per-view. I believe that would have been, that would have probably been December of 98. He was watching Undertaker vs. Stone Cold in the Philippines, where my family is from. I never had cable, so I'd catch as much as I could at my friend's house, who had an illegal black box. God, those were like lifesavers. I've been hooked ever since. You know, it's funny you mentioned the black box, because I didn't get cable until 1995. I had been a WWE fan long before that, and my exposure to Raw would come when my grandmother would tape the shows for me. And she didn't tape them every week, so I didn't get to see Raw every single week, but I saw the key stuff. Because there are a lot of times if anything big happened on Raw, they would pretty much replay it on Superstars or Wrestling Challenge. But yeah, as big of a WWE fan as I was going back to the mid-80s, I missed out on all those years of primetime wrestling and All-American Wrestling, and even the early Monday Night Raws, which I've now seen all of them, but I didn't get to see any of that in full week by week as a kid. I only saw bits and pieces of it. So finally got cable in 95, and a friend of mine also had cable, but he had the black box. And so whenever I went to order a pay-per-view, I had no problem ordering a pay-per-view. But he would invite me over to come watch, and we would go over, and it was because he had the black box, so he didn't have to pay for it. Now, he had to do some weird shit with the antenna to get it to work, and every now and then it would go out, which would piss me off. But yeah, I remember those days vividly. As a matter of fact, I was at his house in 1999 when we were watching Over the Edge that year. Went to his house and had the black box, got the pay-per-view, and we're watching the show and we're sitting there. And they put the graphic up on the screen hyping up the Godfather Blue Blazer match that was coming up for the Intercontinental Belt. And they went to a video hyping the match, and the video ends, and we see a shot of the crowd, and we hear Jim Ross talking. And it didn't hit us at first, because I think me and him were having a conversation, but after 20 seconds of showing the crowd and nothing was happening, I said, this is weird, something must be going on. And, it was one of those things where, actually, I take that back, I got myself mixed up a little bit. They showed the video, and then they went back to the promo graphic, showing Godfather and Blue Blazer, and at that point, you can hear Jim Ross in the background, and that was when he made the comment. He said, "We've got big problems out here," and that was a little weird. At that point, I knew something was wrong. And then they went to the promo backstage that Blue Blazer cut with Kevin Kelly, and then they came back, and then they showed a shot of the crowd. And at that point, our attention, obviously everyone's attention, was on what was going on. And my friend was actually joking with me at that point. He was saying, could you imagine if he actually died? Because I don't think either one of us, nobody expected that Owen Hart was going to die. We thought, oh God, there was an accident. Maybe he fell a certain amount of feet and broke his leg or suffered some sort of injury. And I shouldn't even say we were joking so much as we were just kind of talking about what might happen. Oh, could you imagine if he actually died? Can you imagine the lawsuits and everything from that? And we didn't really think anything of it after that. We knew something bad had happened, but they continued on with the pay-per-view. So our first thought is, well, if they're continuing on with the show, can't be that bad. I'm sure if the guy died, they wouldn't have continued the show. And then they had this, I think it was an 8-man tag with the Union, which at the time was Test and Shamrock and Mankind and Big Show, which is still kind of ironic that Vince McMahon would have a union gimmick in WWE when he's worked so hard against unions in the past. But that match ended. The commentators were laying back. They weren't saying anything. Mankind was the last one to leave the ring. He was, celebrating. And then they went to Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler at ringside, and you could just tell by the expression on their face that we were about to hear something that was not good. And that was when they made the announcement that he actually died. And I just remember sitting there with my friend watching this with our mouths just agape, just wide open, like we just couldn't believe what we just heard. And I don't remember exactly what happened after that. I stuck around for the rest of the show because I wanted to take the tape back home with me so I can have it and show my brother. And I actually, when I came home, my friend didn't live very far from me at the time. I just walked home after that. And I remember I walked up the stairs, and I got to the front door. I opened the front door, and before I even started walking up the steps in the house, since we were on the upper level, I actually started crying, believe it or not. My brother came out. And he said, I just saw something on the news. They were hyping something for the 11 o'clock news about a professional wrestler who died, because he didn't know what happened. And then he sees me crying. He's like, what the hell's the matter with you? And I said, I know who the wrestler was. And I told him, I said, it was Owen Hart. He's like, get out of here. And obviously it was. So I have some pretty vivid memories from that night. I don't know how I got on this from your black box comment, but it just made me think about that. I have a lot of memories from that one night, and that might have actually been the last black box pay-per-view that I got. Well, I didn't get it. My friend got it, but I think after that, I pretty much would stay home and watch all the shows. But so you don't ever have to write in and ask me if I remember where I was when I heard about Owen Hart's death. I can remember it like it was yesterday. All right, do a few more here. This comes from James, writes in. He says, while it feels like I've been a wrestling fan forever, I can only remember watching it on a consistent basis since August of 2002. However, while that is as long as I can remember, I have seen home movies with wrestling on the television with guys like Bret Hart, Owen Hart, and Razor Ramon, so you may be able to chalk that up to me being a fan a little bit longer. First experience I remember was a Sunday night with nothing on TV until I hit Sunday Night Heat on what I think was either the new TNN or MTV when they were beginning to run down the card for SummerSlam. You may be able to chalk this up to me being a stupid child, but with the flashing lights, music, and dudes getting beaten up and bleeding drew me in. My earliest memories were of the build-up to a street fight between Shawn Michaels and Triple H, as well as The Rock, and this monster of a man in Brock Lesnar. I remember asking my father about it, and watching Raw and SmackDown with him from week to week became a bonding experience for us that lasted quite some time. It even ran up to watching Kofi Kingston debuting on ECW and making fun of his stupid gimmick. Sadly, me and my father do not have that kind of relationship anymore, but for the time it lasted, it was fun and will remain a vital part of why I watch wrestling. It's from our buddy Sky, writes in. He says, I've been a wrestling fan my entire life, so it's almost impossible for me to remember exactly when I first became a fan. As a kid, I had wrestling buddies, wrestling figures, video games, and all that stuff. When I called my mother to wish her a happy birthday for Mother's Day, I brought her up to speed on what is happening in the wrestling world because she just doesn't read the dirt sheets and told me that she became a fan not too long before I came along. I do remember my first live event, the highlight of which was Shawn Michaels and Diesel in a tag match against some team. I do remember my mother yelling at me because I saw two kids flipping the middle fingers to IRS, so I thought it was cool. When I joined them, my mom came up behind me and told me never to do that again. The first sound off I listened to was before SummerSlam 2010. I can't tell you how much your show has changed the way I look at wrestling. Listening to that first episode opened up a door that can never be closed. It's like I awoke from the Matrix and saw the real wrestling world for the first time. Without your show, I would not be the wrestling fan that I am today. So I appreciate that, and I think that's a good thing. At some point, you get older, you get wiser, and you become hip to what wrestling really is. And you know what? If you weren't listening to my show, you'd be listening to somebody else's show or, you know, reading something else. And I like to think of myself, like I said, I've been a wrestling fan a long time, just like many of you. And, you know, I try to be fair about it. I tell you what I like, what I don't like. And you know, it's an entertaining show, I assume, or else you wouldn't be listening. So I'm happy that you are the wrestling fan you are today because of the sound off. That makes me feel good. All right, last one I'll do here for this week. We'll get some more next week. This one comes from David. So, Solid Monster, I really enjoy your podcast. Just got done to listening to episode 158 and just wanted to share when I got into wrestling. So this day, the early 90s of WCW was my favorite. With Sting, Ricky Steamboat, Vader, Dustin Rhodes, Barry Windham, Flying Brian, Nikita Koloff, and a group that I hated as a kid, the Dangerous Alliance. With that, I have a question for you. Where do you rank the Dangerous Alliance as the top heel group, among the top heel groups, I should say, in wrestling history? It's kind of funny you mention that, because whenever I, in my brain, go back over all the factions, it's this little exercise I do when I'm bored. Every now and then, I'll think to myself, can I name off the top of my head, without looking online, every single wrestling faction ever? And obviously, it's an impossible question, and I'm pretty good with it. I usually am able to name most of them from WWF, WCW, and ECW, even though I wasn't the biggest WCW fan as a kid. I remember, you know, the Dungeon of Doom, and going back before that, of course, the Horsemen, and the York. I remember the York Foundation, for Christ's sake. You know, Marlena from WWF, she used to be in, well, that's how she met. Dustin Rhodes was in WCW, and she had this group called the York Foundation. They had the Varsity Club and all this different stuff. But the Dangerous Alliance is one I always forget. I never, ever remember to name them in the list. They just, it's like they never existed. And I don't know why, because my memories of the Dangerous Alliance, you know, they were a pretty good heel faction. I wouldn't rank them high as being among the best of all time. Obviously, they didn't leave a great impression on me, since I always forget about them. But they deserve to be on the list. I don't know why it always slips my mind. And Paul Heyman, back in his Paulie Dangerously days, was very good. Again, he was a great manager, which goes to what I was talking about earlier when it comes to managers. But it's funny. I mean, I can, again, rattle off all the different ones. You know, recently, of course, we've had the Nexus and the Core, and in more recent years, we've had Evolution and Team Angle and the Hart Foundation and the Alliance, which is what they called WCW and ECW. And, you know, you had the ECW Originals and the New Breed, and you had the New Blood and the Millionaires Club at the end of WCW, and the Misfits in Action, the Filthy Animals, and Team Canada, and Three Count, and, you know, the Oddities, and the Job Squad, and the WWF, and the Truth Commission, and DOA, and The Nation, Los Boricuas, the NWO, the NWO Wolfpack. Ted DiBiase had a faction that also, I think, gets forgotten, called the Million Dollar Corporation, long before Vince McMahon had his corporation. The Brood. God, who am I forgetting? La Familia, of course. Edge and Vicky and the Edgeheads, they were a faction. Chavo was part of that group. JBL had his cabinet. He had Jillian Hall, and he had the Bashams and Orlando Jordan. So, again, there's been a ton of different factions over the years. But the Dangerous Alliance does not get the credit it deserves. I agree. They were a good group who I think is often forgotten. So that's going to wrap up the mailbag for this week. Keep sending in your stories. Keep sending me other questions as well. TheSolidMonster@gmail.com. I do read everything, and I try to get to as much as I can on the air. Again, Twitter.com/SolidMonster is the place to go on Twitter, and Facebook.com/TheSolidMonster on Facebook. You can friend me on there. And don't forget, there's also a fan page on Facebook for the Solid Monster Sounds Off, so you can go there and like that page. And you can subscribe to this very show through iTunes. It's free. It'll be delivered automatically to you each week. A new episode is posted. It does not get any easier than that. So on that note, be well, stay safe, and don't forget, enjoy Kane Day coming up this week on May 19th. See you next week.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
I am AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solid Monster sounds off on scoops.com.